And good evening. I'm Roger Wendell, welcoming everybody to the Thursday evening call-in show. This evening, my guest is Dr. Albert Bartlett, Professor Emeritus, Department of Physics at the University of Colorado. Dr. Bartlett holds a BA degree from Colgate University and a master's and PhD degrees in nuclear physics from Harvard University. He has been a faculty member of the University of Colorado since 1950. Professor, welcome to the program. Doctor, you've certainly been involved in an impressive array of papers and presentations over the years on not only topics of science, but growth and population issues as well. And that in particular is the subject of this evening's program. And I want to start out with by asking you, is population growth one of our most pressing problems?
Well, it certainly is. Population growth globally is something like 80 million to 90 million a year. Population growth in the United States is the order of 2.5 million a year. And population growth, I think, in the United States is the worst problem we have. And it's also the worst global population problem on the earth, simply because of the very high per capita consumption of resources that we have here in the United States.
Okay, that certainly sounds serious. Backing up just for a moment, I'm curious, when did you first perceive population and growth to be a problem?
Well, it was back around 1969. We had a great national interest among students, young people, in problems of the environment. We were beginning to see more environmental degradation. And I came gradually to realize that people didn't understand the simple arithmetic of, say, 2% growth, 3% growth, something like this, how large the numbers could become in modest periods of time. And I started giving a lecture in September, first gave it in September of 1969, on arithmetic, population, and energy, and I've been giving it ever since.
Interesting. Also want to remind listeners that we will be taking calls here at KGNU, 449-4885. Professor, you mentioned environmental degradation and growing numbers, certainly problems, and I'd like you to elaborate on that further. But what is the problem? Isn't more better? I mean, we've got all kinds of people now to help solve problems. We certainly love the social and human contact. What's the problem with greater numbers?
Well, the greater numbers gives you, for instance, right here in Boulder, you can see the congestion. I think population growth is one of the factors that people most often cite in Boulder when they cite problems that they'd like to see solved. And you see congestion on the streets, you see congestion in the schools. It's very interesting that it's quite clear that population growth interferes with economic development. We have in this country right now many, many people who are homeless, people who are at the bottom of the economic ladder. These people are largely neglected as we rush to try to take care of the well-to-do people who are fostering the growth. And so we don't have the resources to go and try to help poor people, the resources that we need.
Well, certainly poor people, the impoverished, are a problem, but haven't those types of problems always been with us way back in time when our numbers were much less than they are today?
I think that is certainly a reasonable observation, but it's interesting when the People's Republic of China some 25 years ago instituted this very coercive one-child-per-family policy, the official statement of the government in support of that policy was population growth interferes with economic growth. So if you want to have better lives for your people, you just try not to have so many people.
Okay, so the Chinese government recognizes then that the population growth is interfering with economic growth, but from what I'm experiencing here, having lived in the front along the Front Range most of my life, is there are growth boosters, city councils, chambers of commerce want us to grow. They assure me that if we have more people along the Front Range, by golly, me and not only me but my children as well will have jobs. Certainly that can't be false.
Well, it certainly isn't true. The one thing you need to realize is, for instance, that population growth is often promoted by people who say, well, we have to create jobs. And did you know that creating jobs increases the number of people who are out of work? The more jobs you create, the more people there are out of work.
Well, how could that possibly be, though? Take, for example, a large plant, say, near us in Denver. Its plant is open up for Nike, for example. More jobs are created. How could that diminish the supply of jobs?
Well, what happens is that when you have an equilibrium unemployment rate, suppose it's 5%, and a big company comes in, opens a big factory, and the unemployment rate drops to 4%. So then people move in to take the jobs and restore the equilibrium unemployment to 5%. And it's 5% now of a larger population because people moved in. So I can guarantee you, every time you create 100 new jobs, you in effect create 5 more unemployed people.
Okay, so it's a matter then of the mobile population, people seeking a job.
Absolutely correct.
Well, that kind of takes us backwards just a little bit, and you're suggesting that this mobility of the workforce, distributing the work and the job supply, then we've got this global, international economy. Then where is the population problem the worst, then, if we're all so mobile?
Well, it's the problem is the worst here in the U.S. simply because of our high per capita consumption. The average American will consume in a lifetime perhaps 30 to 50 times as much in terms of resources as the average person will in some underdeveloped nation in a lifetime. And so our impact on resources in North America is kind of the same order of magnitude as the impact of the entire rest of the world.
Even the Chinese that are, 1.2 billion now?
Yes. Yeah. And you see, they aspire to have automobiles per capita the same as we have, if you just do the arithmetic on it to see, well, what would be the impact on world petroleum production, it's just staggering.
Okay, well, apparently the Chinese themselves, though, are heavily involved in petroleum production, or at least attempting to, as the Soviets and the present-day Russians are. Surely there's enough oil to go around.
Absolutely not. And let me give you the facts, and I have a paper that I've submitted to one of the geology journals to just outlining this. It looks as though in the United States, my calculations suggest that we have now consumed approximately 3/4 of the recoverable oil that was ever in the ground in the United States. Now, the pattern of rise and fall of the production of a non-renewable resource is one in which it rises to a maximum, and then comes back down, falls down toward zero. Now, in U.S., that peak was reached in 1970, and we've been declining ever since in production. But consumption keeps going up because we can just import more, and we had a Gulf War to help guarantee that we could continue to import. Now, what about the world resource? The world resource is very near the peak. Any time now, it can start down, and my analysis suggests that if the total world resource is 2,000 billion barrels, and that's a number I find in the geology literature, very common, plus or minus 30%.
Can you rate 2,000 billion barrels as to, say, the annual consumption here in the United States, just for perspective?
I would have to do some arithmetic on that, and I'd have to look up to see what the present number in the United States is, around 20 million barrels per day. So 20 million, let's see, 20 million into...
sounds like nearly a billion, just
times,
off the top of my head.
2 times 10 to the 12th divided by 2 times 10 to the 7th. That means that the total world resource that was ever here would last U.S. consumption presently for about 10,000 years. 100,000 years, I'm sorry, about 100,000 years.
Well, that's a pretty impressive expansive time, though. I don't really see what the problem would be if the Russians and the Chinese all owned 3 cars and...
Yeah, but right now, we're near the peak. We've used 1,000 billion barrels.
Oh, okay, half of it.
And the world total has used around 1,000 billion, and the curve is ready to turn down any time, and in fact, my detailed analysis suggests that it'll hit the maximum around the year 2004.
And then we'll be on the downside of the bell curve, as
it
were.
And now think what's going to happen when you have a growing population worldwide, growing per capita demand for oil, and you have the production going down. Now, when that happened in the U.S., we just imported more. But when we're talking about the whole world, there's no place we can import it for.
But haven't we been assured through science and technology that the mind of man, rather, can overcome this problem, and there will be a substitute for petroleum?
Well,
that this won't be an issue if we should ever run out.
Well, that's the word that you get from some economists, and in particular you get that from the economist Julian Simon, who is at the University of Maryland. He says we'll never run out of anything, and the arguments he gives just simply do not stand up to detailed scrutiny. For instance, he says, we will never run out of oil because, and I'll quote this, this is from a book of his that's published by the Princeton University Press. He says, we'll never run out of oil, and even if there's a problem, he says, because we can depend on the sun's energy, and he says, even if the sun were not so vast as it is, there may well be other suns elsewhere. Now, he is clearly intimating that if our sun runs out of energy, we'll figure out how to go get another sun. Now, I don't know anyone who thinks that seriously, other than Julian Simon, that that's an option.
Right.
We're going to have to live with what we've got.
Well, a parallel argument I've heard is that, indeed, we will not run out of oil. The last barrel of oil will never be sold because it'll be so incredibly expensive, thus forcing us to change to a different technology.
Now, that's right. And as you go over the peak, you can look for oil to become more expensive. And we're in serious trouble in the U.S. because we've used three-quarters of our oil. We're importing more than half of the oil we use now every day. And so we can look for oil, cost of oil, to go up at some point. And it's interesting that the Middle East countries have the world's largest remaining oil. And it's also interesting that the geologists have now very good ways of estimating how much oil remains undiscovered. Now, 100 years ago, somebody did some arithmetic on U.S. oil and said, oh, gee, the U.S. will be out in 20 years or 25 years. Well, we obviously were not. All they did then was to take the amount of oil that had been discovered, divided by how rapidly it was then being used, and come up with 20 or 25 years. Now, we have very good ways of knowing how much oil is undiscovered. Both statistical studies and detailed geology studies, so we have pretty good ideas, plus or minus, 30 or 40%, something like this.
Okay.
But so we can say now with some certainty about how long the oil will last. And now it isn't that it's going to suddenly run out; it's just going to start down that curve, downhill. Production will fall just as it's been falling in the U.S. After 1970, it fell for several years. Then the Alaska pipeline started delivering. There was a slow recovery, but it never got up to the peak where it had been. And now Alaska pipeline has peaked, and that's going downhill. And everything's going down in unison. Now, you hear about drilling on the North Slope. I've seen the estimate that
the Arctic Wildlife Refuge.
I've seen the estimate that they might find 3.2 billion barrels of oil up there. That's less than 1 year's consumption in the United States. There was a headline in the Wall Street Journal on April 1st of last year telling about opening up of the new Hibernia oil field that's in the Atlantic Ocean south of Newfoundland. And it said, oh, this will last for 50 years. That's in the headline, will last 50 years. It tells in the body of the story that there may be 1 billion barrels of oil there. 1 billion barrels is 56 days' worth of oil in the United States.
That's at present consumption rates, and that's not...
At the present consumption rate, it's 56 days, and the headline said, will last 50 years.
Well, these figures sound pretty impressive, and apparently governments are aware of these figures. And if what you say is true concerning the substitute technology, we're going to run out of oil eventually, especially if the Chinese and the Russians partake of the type of consumption we're accustomed to here in the United States. We're going to run out. There's nothing to make a substitute with. Why do these governments, especially our government, even our municipal governments, our state governments, insist on growth?
Well, at the local level, I think we all trust our national leaders. And we don't hear statements of these problems from our national leaders. And so we go blithely on thinking, well, everything is all right. Now, let me tell you a story. I dropped out of college for a while. I worked as a dishwasher on iron ore freighters on the Great Lakes in 1941 and 42. And we used to get 10,000 tons of iron ore, rich ore from the Mesabi Range, come down, throw it in a blast furnace, go up and get another 10,000 tons. I used to wonder, will we ever run out of this? And I remember clearly dismissing the thought from my mind, because I thought, well, there are intelligent people in Washington. There are intelligent people in the company office. If we ever are in danger of running out, they will let us know. Well, we've run out. Now they are processing very low-quality taconite. They have to bring it down, and it's a much more difficult process. But now they're using much lower-grade ore. But now the technology has sort of stepped in and made it possible to use a lower-grade ore. But
well, there's that technological answer again. Now, we're using a lower-grade ore.
And people cite that. But, you know, I tell the story simply to say that we all trust our leaders. And now it became clear to me some years ago that on the question of running out of resources, they're not going to tell us about it.
Right. You mentioned earlier that, in your opinion, that the worst population problem was here in the United States, and it's based on our consumption levels. Besides the consumption levels, do we still have a population problem here in the U.S.? In other words, the quality of our lives, just by the overcrowding, and you mentioned some of the traffic problems here in Boulder. I've driven across Nevada, Arizona, Wyoming, even parts of Colorado. Looks wide open to me. It looks like there's plenty of elbow room for all of us. We can open up the borders, let everybody in. What's the problem?
Well, people to live have to have water. They have to have food. And I've driven across those wonderful wide open spaces on Highway 50 going across Nevada. It's a wonderful drive.
50's the best, yeah.
Yeah, it's the best. But it isn't any place that you would want to buy a lot and set up housekeeping, because water is a real problem. And you look, for instance, at water in some of these wide open spaces. Out in Nevada, Las Vegas now, the demand for water is such that they are buying up water rights in the northern part of the state and essentially taking the water away from the farmers, and so they are destroying agriculture up there so they can have swimming pools and lakes and big things in their resorts down around Las Vegas. And so the question then is the same thing out here in the Ogallala Aquifer that underlies eastern Colorado, western Kansas, Nebraska. The water level there has been lowered significantly by the pumping, in this case, these cases, for agriculture. And it's becoming more costly each year to get bigger pumps to lift the water higher up from
sure.
deeper in the ground. And so at some point, well, it's clear we are using the water more rapidly than it's being recharged by the natural processes. So we're mining the water. When it's gone, why, it'll be gone except for those that can afford the very biggest and deepest pumps. So again, we're forcing out the little people. Only the rich people will be able to afford the water. So yes, there's lots of open space, but there aren't the resources necessary to support them.
Okay. So something that I was trying to get at also was just to see what your propensity is for enduring crowding, and just imagining for a moment unlimited resources, something similar to maybe Hong Kong, where there seems to be enough water as far as I know. There are a lot of people packed into a small place. Is that something you and I could stand? Could our collective psyches as a civilization, especially in North America, stand just more people, even if we could provide them with the water and resources we've been talking about?
Well, let me just answer that in two different ways. First of all, if you cite Hong Kong, it's very crowded. People often cite the Netherlands as being a very densely populated place where the life quality is quite high, very good, and it's a very civilized place. And they say, well, now, you know, we could put the whole United States to that same density. What you have is a very interesting concept that's been developed up in British Columbia by a professor at the University of British Columbia. And he talks about ecological footprints. And so what he does is to say, take the average person, all the consumption, food and other resources, energy and so on, and say, well, now how large a land area is necessary to support one person? And then multiply that by the number of people in British Columbia, and you find, well, the area is something like, or in the Vancouver area, the area required is something like the state of Washington plus the state of Oregon. If you apply that to the Netherlands, the area you need to support the people of the Netherlands, to supply them with food and other things, is something like the area of France. And when you apply it to the entire world, living at varying standards of living, dietary standards and so on as we have now, it essentially takes the whole world's available agricultural land to support the present population. And if you say, we are going to take the present population of the world and raise them to our Western standard of living here in the United States, it'll take two more Earths.
Apparently so.
Okay. Now, there's one other aspect of it that I want to mention. This is a wonderful statement. It's one of the most profound statements I've read in some time. Isaac Asimov, being interviewed by Bill Moyers. And Moyers asked Asimov, he said, well, what happens to the dignity of the human spirit if this population growth continues? And Asimov says it'll be completely destroyed. He said, I like to use my bathroom metaphor. He said, if two people live in an apartment and there are two bathrooms, then both people have freedom of the bathroom. You can go to the bathroom anytime you want. But, he said, if there are 20 people in the apartment and only two bathrooms, and nobody has freedom of the bathroom, no matter how much you may believe in it, you don't have it. And then he says, and this is the very profound observation, he said, democracy cannot survive over population. He said, human decency cannot survive over population. As you put more and more people into the world, the value of a life not only declines, it disappears. It doesn't matter, he says, if someone dies, the more people there are, the less one person matters. Now, you can see the destruction of democracy in the United States just as a result of population growth.
Interesting. I want to remind listeners, I'm Roger Wendell, and my guest this evening is Dr. Albert Bartlett, Professor Emeritus, Department of Physics from the University of Colorado. And on this Thursday evening call-in show, we're addressing population and growth issues. I'm inviting callers to give us a ring here at the studio at 449-4885. Doctor, we've certainly covered a wide range of problems and possibilities associated with growth and population, and want to readdress some of it a little bit here. And we were talking about the quality of life here in the United States and Colorado. I'm curious, what is your opinion and feelings towards immigration? That seems to be a hot button as of late, especially within the environmental movement. I understand there's a lot of internal turmoil over positions to be taken by the Sierra Club and other organizations on immigration and its effect here on the United States.
If you look at population growth in the U.S. today, it's about 2.5 to 3 million people added every year. Something like half of that is immigration. Now, as I mentioned, wrote in that paper on sustainability, the first law of sustainability is you cannot sustain population growth. So as long as we have population growth from any source, we are moving away from sustainability. And so we have to stop population growth in the U.S. And it's very, a number of analysts have looked at this, and for instance, the National Academy of Sciences have some data. These are projections. They're subject to the errors of all projections, but they show that if we had zero immigration, the population of the U.S. would continue to increase, but gradually declining rate. So finally it would level off.
Without immigration.
Without immigration around the year 2040. But if you keep up a low level or intermediate or high levels of immigration, that leveling off is postponed. And in fact, if you get a what they call a high level of immigration, it will never level off. It will never stop growing.
Interesting. It brings to mind just what we're founded on here as a nation of immigrants. I mean, it almost sounds as like heresy. We're contributing to this problem by allowing immigration. Is that what you're saying?
That is correct. And what we're saying is that the average American consumes something like 30 times the amount of resources that anyone else consumes, and we have a dual responsibility. One is to get our total consumption down. And, for instance, just the conference in Kyoto here last November or December, the question of global warming. That's directly due to population growth and to per capita consumption of fossil fuels. We've got to get both of them down. We cannot go on in an island, isolated island in the U.S. with our high consumption rates. We've got to get those down. But at the same time, the best way to get them down is to level off our population and even get the population to decline for a while. And Professor David Pimentel, who is an agricultural scientist at the University, Cornell University in New York State, he estimates that the sustainable population of the U.S. based on today's dietary standards is about 100 million people, and we're up about 2.5 times that. And he estimates that the world's sustainable population is about 2 billion, and we're up approaching 6 billion now on the world. Now, this is to give people good food, good diet, good resources, and sustainable. So sustainable means can go on for a long period of time.
Doctor, if you don't mind, we'll take a few calls here in a minute or two, but I'd like to address this idea of sustainability. The word sustained development and sustainability came up in the conversation a few times, and I know that may be a contentious issue. I had the pleasure of reading two of your papers, one entitled, Is There a Population Problem?, and the other, Reflections of Sustainability, coincidentally, Population Growth and the Environment. So if you could take a moment and address the sustainability issue.
The first law of sustainability is you cannot sustain population growth, nor can you sustain growth in the rates of consumption of resources. This is based on arithmetic. This isn't just an opinion. I think that law is as absolute as Newton's laws of motion.
But isn't this what the Green Party and the Enviros are telling us, sustainability?
They use it all the time without understanding, many of them, that that means stopping the population growth. You have to. You cannot. Just look at the arithmetic. You cannot sustain population growth, period. And so you cannot save the environment if you have continued population growth. So if environmentalists are somehow, and some of them do feel, that we should not try to address population problems, then they are saying we kiss the environment goodbye. But they somehow think that we can have the environment and we can still have population growth.
Okay. Let's take a moment and go to the phones. Let's see if Sasha is still with us. Sasha, are you there?
Yes, I am.
After you.
Okay. I've got just a few quick points here. I'm definitely on the same page as the doctor, and I think I have been since I was a small child, oddly enough. I don't know how that happens. But my questions are these. I see things such as the overconsumption in North America and the greed that comes along with it as a big part of the problem. The ignorance that I think a large amount of the population, not just here, but maybe everywhere, has, that we live on a finite ball of resources and in an ever-increasing amount of population. We also have churches, namely the Catholic Church, speaking out against contraception and, I guess, encouraging spreading of one's seed.
Certainly a timely topic, yeah.
Excuse me?
Certainly a timely topic with the Pope in Cuba,
yeah,
as we speak.
And we also have the fact that healthcare in the last 100 years has taken such major strides that we just simply don't die off the way we used to. People that normally, let's say, in a natural world would be would have died off, and with the stronger in the pool surviving, etc., which may be a little bit towards the evolution side of things, but nevertheless, it's the truth. We're keeping more and more people alive that would otherwise pass away. So faced with all of these things, I haven't figured out the answer as to how can people get the world to change. I mean, I don't ever see the day happening where I'm alive here where people agree in North America to only have one child per couple or anything towards that effect, and I haven't exactly figured out how anybody's ever going to get that to happen.
Kind of a solutions question, Doctor, I was hoping to ask at the end of the show, but we can address it now.
Well, let's look at it now. Right now in Europe, most all the industrial countries are either at zero population growth or negative population growth.
As Canada as well.
Yeah, and for instance, in Spain and Italy, which are perhaps the most Catholic countries in the world, they both have negative population growth. Now, there have been alarmists who write columns in the New York Times, which are picked up then by the Boulder Camera, who say, oh my gosh, this is a terrible disaster. We've got to start producing more people. And what in fact is, I think that those countries, whether it's part of their conscious thinking about it or not, they are moving towards sustainability by having declining populations. Now, I don't know the reasons for this in Spain and Italy. One can speculate, for instance, at the high cost of raising children and the requirement now, economic requirement more and more, that both husband and wife be employed in order to get enough income. those working together may cause this.
An economic requirement, not required by law.
No, okay. you're right. Economic requirements just to get by. Now, in the Eastern Bloc countries, former Soviet Union countries, there the economic times are so hard that they very quickly went from positive to negative growth very quickly as the people realized that the times were extremely difficult. So, and now what you find also now in many parts of Asia, that the fertility rates, namely the number of children per woman, are dropping very rapidly. And I think that a major factor that we must address in order to get even more better results here is the education of women.
Right.
I think the liberation and education of women is probably one of the most effective things that we can do in order to get the population growth down. But there's another way that works very well, and there is a group called Population Communications International. They are a group of high-level television and producers. They will go into a country that has a national television network. They will work with local writers, actors, producers, camera people, and so on to produce soap operas in the native tongue and everything that have family planning as the central part of the soap opera. And these things, they've quoted some very effective, very significant lowering of fertility rates in some underdeveloped nations as a result of their television broadcasts.
Sasha, any other questions?
No, I guess maybe wanted to hear from somebody else that they actually feel that there's a possibility to bring things into a controllable state, but I appreciate the response.
Well, I think thank you for your comments,
you.
And I think that the opportunities and are there for making some real change. We just got to keep our eye on the target.
Okay, this idea of fertility, something I like to refer to in this country myself as fertility fever. Dr. Bartlett, what's going on here? Why do we have to have multiple births? Why do we go gaga over somebody having 6, 7, and maybe even 8 children someday? Where's that coming from?
I really don't know. It must be deeply ingrained in our society, and I simply don't know where it comes from.
Okay, let's go back to the phones and see if Karen is with us.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for waiting, Karen.
You bet. You bet. Professor Bartlett, first of all, I'd like to thank you and acknowledge you for the wonderful work that you're doing and getting the word out about how people need to be thinking about these things.
Thank you very much. I want to mention
that I am active with the Greens and the Green Party, and part of what we're trying to do similarly is to also get people to think about the consequences of their actions, the consequences of mindless consumption, the consequences of having children that may or may not be actively planned or wanted, the consequences of what we do in our everyday lives, whether it's, you know, just get in the car and turn on the automatic pilot, or whether you remember to take the bag to the grocery store. It's a whole variety. It's a whole grand variety of things that people can do in their individual lives if and only if they have the awareness of which you speak. So my question is, how do we get people to be more aware and to think very seriously about the consequences of their actions in their daily lives, in their reproductive behavior, and in the marketplace? How do we get people to do that, assuming that we're not going to bring down Big Brother government, because people are tired of that, assuming that there's not going to be a crisis of sorts, there's not going to be a crisis, maybe there already is of sorts?
Well, your question is a very good one, and it gets right to the heart of how do we do this? How do we do it within the framework of American democracy and respect for the Constitution of the United States and everything? And my general answer is we have to work through education and example. We have to do our best to educate people When we see people saying that bigger is better, we have to ask them, please explain why this is. I've discussed this with some developers and found, for instance, let me just spell one thing out. The growth never pays for itself. You have to pay higher taxes to support the growth. And these guys always go around and say, oh, well, we get a broader tax base. We get a bigger tax base. We get more tax income. And, you know, it even looks here in Colorado with all the state surplus money that has presumably come from growth, that maybe the growth is paying for itself. But then you look at the highways are a mess. You look at the schools in many cases are in serious trouble. Schools are overcrowded. In the local school district, you have to vote new school bonds all the time in order to just provide new schools for the growth. And I can give you figures on this. But I think we have to just educate people to the fact that the growth never pays for itself. And it's very nicely explained by Garrett Hardin, the biologist, in his essay called The Tragedy of the Commons. He points out how in a medieval village there may have been a common green area, and every family in the village had cattle that grazed on the green. And each family realizes, if I enlarge my number of cattle, then the profit from that enlargement comes to me. But by the time every community family has done this, they've overgrazed, they've destroyed the resource, and they all have to pay. They all suffer. And so the message is that the benefits of growth accrue to a few, but the cost of growth have to be carried by the whole community.
But in your commons example, it was evident to everybody involved what the problem was. And
yes.
I think what Karen was alluding to earlier is, how do we make all the folks in Boulder County, Colorado, and the United States aware of this problem? It's not so evident.
Well, it's not so evident, and of course technology is a big factor in hiding the obvious. In other words, before the days of central sewer systems, each family had to get rid of their own family waste. But now we can flush it down the toilet, and it goes away. And the modern technology of the civil engineering, of sanitary sewer systems, and so on, relieves us of responsibility for what we're doing. And we have the same sort of thing in many, many aspects of technology. They remove us from contact with the problems we create. And so we just have to educate people to the fact that this is what's happening. And I appreciate your efforts for working on this and your recognition of the problem. Thank you very much.
And thank you. I just hope it doesn't take a crisis like another oil crisis. You've already addressed that to some degree. I just hope it doesn't take a major, major crisis.
I hope so also.
Wake up.
Karen, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Yep. Doctor, you mentioned technology, and I know from your paper, Reflections on Sustainability, Population Growth, and the Environment, you said there that the use of technology has encouraged growth.
Yes.
Now, if you could explain that, because I know we've been talking here, and it appears to me as though technology maybe supplements growth or eases the way for growth, but how does it actually encourage it?
Well, if you have, for instance, building highways and having automobiles available, these are results of technology. And by building superhighways now, people can drive long distances to commute to work. And in the old days, you had to live fairly close to where you worked, so you didn't consume much in getting to and from work. We can now ship strawberries from California to New York by truck, enormously expensive in terms of use of fuel, but it's because we have the interstate highways. And so the interstate highways, in fact, it's a fundamental law of highway building that you don't build new highways or add lanes to existing highways in order to alleviate traffic jams. You build them to enlarge the traffic jams. In other words, if you build a suburban highway, it will generate sufficient new traffic that wasn't there before to fill the new highway to capacity. So all highways tend to be filled to capacity.
Just on an intuitive level, I'd have to agree from my experience on C-470 and the new E-470 down in Denver. Heavens, try to get to Parker. There's more traffic than I ever imagined. If you don't mind, let's go back to the phones. We've got quite a few callers. Let's try, I think it's Damien. Are you with us still?
Sam. Thank you.
I'm sorry, say that again, please.
It's Damon.
Damon, okay.
Yes,
thanks for calling and thanks for waiting.
Thank you. Yes, once again, my question is solutions. And I guess my major concern or question in my work with sustainable development in Thailand is, how do you apply these facts of population growth, limited resources within the systems that exist, economic systems, particularly capitalism and right now transnational corporations, which bring on even new questions of patenting, international patents of alternative energy sources, basically using energy sources until we get the highest price and then introducing the new technology, and the question of sustainability on what level. My own experience suggests that sustainability is really done on a much smaller level, and our system relies on consumerism. And so how do you introduce the idea of sustainability within this economic system which needs consumerism, which needs growth? That is the basis of it. And how do you base the sustainability on a small level without breaking into regionalism and nationalism?
Good question. Now, apparently parallel to Karen's question, how do you introduce that into a system that's basically based on the idea of growth?
Yeah. Well, Damon, I agree. You got your finger on the real difficult problems, and I'm not sure I've got all the answers. If you've been in Thailand, then I suspect, I have not been there, but I suspect that in a rural area you have people that are much closer to sustainability than we are. Because they're close to agriculture, they're close to the land. We here in Boulder County, we're kicking agriculture out. We're throwing it out as we pave over the lands. And right. Some people may think that we don't need farmers as long as we have supermarkets. But what we know in the long run is that a population that's going to have a sustainable society, they're going to be in equilibrium with nature. And the last sustainable society in this part of the world was probably 200 years ago, the Native Americans. Now, they had a very difficult life. It was tough. They were in many ways. But what were the essential things they had? They had low population density. Their footprint on the environment was very light, so that the environment could recover from their passage. But now, you know, we've changed things. We don't have a light footprint on the environment, and the idea of technology has removed from us the recognition of what's essential for sustainability. As long as we can get strawberries from California in December or something like this, we don't have any appreciation of the fact that strawberries don't grow in Colorado in December. And so we can we have essentially tried to get around the laws of nature, and people fool themselves into thinking that nature will let us get away with this forever. But the critical thing now in all of our long-distance transportation of food and other things is petroleum, and I think the petroleum is the thing that's going to give us the first real signals that we're moving away from sustainability.
Yes.
Damon, any other comments?
Yes, I mean, it's all, when you look at it at that scale, it's very hard to see how the idea of sustainability can be brought about on such a interdependent large economic system. And I think in my own sort of research and looking at this question, it really comes down to basic questions that our religions and cultures have been answering and teaching us for a long time about meaning of happiness, satisfaction of human life. And I think what I've seen in third world countries is consumer capitalism coming in and saying, your happiness can be earned through these things. And that's what we've learned here, and cultures are destroyed. And this new sort of carrot at the end of the stick of consumerism is held out. And how that can be held back, as you used the example of the American Indians, much of that had to do with culture. And I think it's very intertwined with the destruction of culture. And the expansion of consumer capitalism.
Good point, Dan.
I agree with you, and I think to try to give a suggestion about your question of how do we do this in this big worldwide global economy, I think the thing we have to do is to say the first law of sustainability is you cannot sustain population growth. And so whenever we see people, whether it's a governor or a chamber of commerce or some promoters, are talking about, gee, how we have to have population growth, and what they say is, well, you environmentalists have to compromise so that, you know, we want to put in a big new shopping center in this wetlands area, and you have to compromise so that we can put it in. And it's never compromise among equals, where the environmentalists say, all right, you take out that subdivision and restore the wetlands that were there, and we'll let you put in this new shopping center that you where you want to destroy some local. It's never.
Now that sounds like a compromise.
That's
sure.
Never among equals. It's always compromise. You environmentalists give up a lot, or do you give up a little? But, you know, if you give up a little enough times in a row, you lose everything.
It certainly sounds like the case, and you know, we've all heard the statistics, maybe a 90-95% loss of our forests, original old-growth forests, and the prairies gone, and the buffalo and that. Yeah, if we keep slicing the pie in half, certainly there won't be much left. Let's move back to the phones. Ken, are you still with us?
Yeah, I am, and I had a comment that goes along the lines of the ones that Damon and Karen were making, but I guess I'm emphasizing a little more of the economics of the situation. It seems to me that the problem, and I don't have much of a background in world travel, so I may be out on a limb on this, but it seems that the problem isn't entirely that there are 6 billion people on the planet. The problem is production for profit. You know, we grow more than enough food, it seems, but when you have a Chicago Board of Mercantile Exchange deciding how much grains will cost, when you have Archer Daniel Midland or General Mills deciding the price of corn and how many people are going to starve to death every day, and they're fighting this constant war of attrition, they, you know, and IMF policies and World Bank policies contribute to this. That's the real issue, and it seems to me that rather than focusing on the producing nations in some of these places like India and the like, we should be focusing on ourselves as consumers and coming to the now very obvious conclusion that consumer capitalism is the problem. Yes, population growth is an issue. Yes, that should be addressed. But we need some sort of sustainable socialism in order to solve or at least address where we are today.
Well, one point of clarification, do you really believe ADM sets the price of corn? Isn't that something that's driven by the market?
I mean, as far as collusion, yeah. Oh, yeah. As far as their collusive behavior and how much market control they have, there's no question. I mean, they have profound influence on the price of all sorts of commodities, raw grain commodities, as do a lot of these other, well, transnational corporations, along with what Damon was speaking. I don't know that he was speaking of it in the terms that I was speaking of it in, but when you look at these globalized nations, you know, transnational corporations like Cargill is the largest landholder in the world. These people are the ones that are really setting this stuff. It isn't a supply and demand economy, you know, for these grain products. It's a collusion economy, and that is really where the focus, I think, should be placed, is like, you know, how can we tell the people in Chicago in no uncertain terms that that has to stop? You know, I mean, and I'm wondering if that's really factored as a central focus in your analysis of this issue.
Well, let me comment on that. First of all, you said we grow more than enough food. That's common belief, but I think if you look at the facts, you find that may not be true. The per capita world grain production has been declining each year since about 1989, something like this. So there have been several years of declining world grain production. World fish production has declined very seriously. We were up in Nova Scotia as tourists in the summer of 1992, and the Canadian government had shut down the entire Canadian Atlantic fishery because the fish were gone, and they were hoping by closing it down that they could give the fish a chance to recover. And I think I've seen something like 80% of the major world fisheries are in serious decline. And so the question of do we have produce enough food, I'm not sure that that's true. And certainly it becomes less true as we go on and have growing populations. the Green Revolution has sort of peaked out, and I don't think that one can expect in the future the big kind of increases in productivity that we've seen in the past. Now, as for the major corporations, that's a very difficult problem. I have heard it said from people who know something about the law that at least in the United States, many of these big mergers that we have seen take place violate the Sherman Antitrust Act, and that it's been decades since there have been a U.S. Attorney General who was willing to go to bat and be a trust buster in the way that Teddy Roosevelt was back around 1902 or whenever he was president. And I think maybe what we need to do is really take a good hard look at whether or not some of these big corporations that combine and buy each other out and so on without adding to productivity at all, to see if some of these aren't actually violating the law. I don't know the law, so I just can't say whether they are or not.
Ken,
thank you.
Thanks for your comments. Let's move on. We've got quite a few callers this evening. Up next, Prem, are you still with us?
Yeah.
Thanks for waiting.
And I had a few comments. I agree with Dr. Bartlett and certainly appreciate over the years how much he's put out in good information with regard to population problems. I'd like to comment on some discontinuities, I guess I'd say, and then sort of lead to something to do with strategy about how we might deal with some of these problems. The price of gasoline, which is a highly refined product, has been pointed out, is less than mineral water, which is a non-processed, right out of the ground product. Obviously, something is being highly manipulated there, and even during the so-called gasoline shortage, we had all kinds of use of gasoline and fuel products that made plastic bags and whatever. In other words, in some sense, it didn't seem like that was a really serious shortage. I'm wondering if Dr. Bartlett could comment on why gasoline is so cheap in some sense, or is that an appropriate way for the market to be?
Well,
Let me go on to just a couple more things, and then I'll get off here rather than taking your time linearly here. With regard to development, there seems to be a lot more land use development happening than there is population increase. I've seen the figure that there's six times more land use happening than population increase. In other words, there's a nonlinearity there somehow or other. It's super exponential. And I think that's something we certainly have to deal with. And then on the immigration issue, the way you've stated it, it appears to be about a 1% issue, whereas the consumerism is about a 3,000% issue. In other words, we have about 30x to the amount of other people, how they live, whereas the increase through immigration is something like 1% of our population per year. And I wonder if it's worth getting into the whole social justice and whatever issues that come from our going around the world taking resources and bringing them home and then saying other people can't come here and use them, to get into that heavily rather than just deal with our consumerism in the first place. So that's basically my three questions, roughly.
Well, thank you. You're right about the price of gasoline being less than the price of bottled water, and this truly doesn't reflect the market or anything like the value of gasoline. And if you go to any other part of the world, I think the price of gasoline, you order $5 a gallon, something like this. And by all that's sacred, it should be that here. But we just have government policies that keep the price low, and the way that which you could raise the price would be to put tax on it and really raise the tax on the gasoline. That's tough to do in a democracy, and you may recall that President Reagan wanted to increase the tax about 5 cents a gallon. He was facing filibusters in the United States Senate against the tax increase simply because people said, oh, our constituents can't, or senators say our constituents can't pay those higher prices. And we fought the Gulf War in order to keep the price of gasoline low, and we exert all kinds of political pressure on Saudi Arabia to keep them producing and to try to keep OPEC from raising their prices. And what we really need is to have higher prices so that we will appreciate how valuable this resource is. Now, you say that the development goes more rapidly than population increase. I've seen that figure, and I think it's probably correct. And this means, then, that we are using more land per person in the sense of destroying it, building houses on it, or subdivisions, or parking lots, or whatever, and that this ought to be looked at within the context of our our constitutional framework to see if we can save some of that land, save it for agriculture. And there are a number of states, I think Maryland is one of the states now, that has developed some very strong laws about zoning so that it makes it much more difficult to take farmland, good productive farmland, and make it into subdivision. In regard to immigration, I think that if you look at it, it's the one right of a sovereign nation to decide who can come in and who cannot. And if we want to increase our national effect, negative effect on global resources, we just let our population increase. And what I think we have to do is to say we have a responsibility to people who own the resources in other countries that we need. We have a responsibility to them to say we will reduce our per capita consumption here and we will try to reduce the total size of our population to get it down to something that is sustainable. It is certainly not sustainable at the present size. Thank you very much.
Graham, thank you. Tom, are you still with us?
Sure am. Kind of basically in response to the first woman that called saying, well, can something positive happen without a crisis or, you know, some type of governmental control? I guess basically I have about two questions. Do we have a chance for this current generation, the people that are alive now, to live their lives out? Do we have a generation to work this problem out? In other words, before we start enacting a solution. The secondary question is it possible there are supranational entities of a corporate structure that may have more cynical minds than the people involved in this discussion, that may already have ideas of how to deal with the situation, possible uses for war, biologicals, etc.?
Well, okay. Let me try to answer your first question. I think certainly we do have a chance to work these things out if we can improve our recognition of the problems we face. And to some extent, I would just dump this on our national leaders and say, why aren't our national leaders up on this, really, really talking more about it, recognizing it, bringing the problems home to the constituents? And one of the things that I think we need most of all to do in the United States is to have a national dialogue on population. What is the size of the problem? What are various people's perceptions of the problem? Get people talking about it, recognizing it's a problem. Do it with some leadership out of Washington. And interestingly enough, the last leadership on population from a president of the United States was Richard Nixon. He chartered the Rockefeller Commission study of population. Their conclusion was they couldn't see any benefit to the U.S. from any further population growth. And let me just couple that with a challenge to everybody. And I've given this challenge many times. Can you think of anything, any problem on any scale, from microscopic to global, whose long-term solution is in any demonstrable way aided, assisted, or advanced by having larger populations? Can you think of anything that will get better by crowding more people into our cities, our towns, our state, our nation, or on the earth? Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. And real quick, John, if you're still with us, you have about a half a minute.
Well, I'll try and get what I can in. I agree with Dr. Bartlett on most everything. A friend of mine who is also a retired college professor once told me that if all the Chinese got vehicles like he'd said, we wouldn't have to worry about running out of oil because we would run out of air first. And you got to have air to run your internal combustion engines. So I was wondering about that. But also, I think a solution would be to start taxing some of the big corporations and not giving them the tax breaks that we do, like auto and steel and oil and big agriculture, tobacco.
Doctor, if you wouldn't mind commenting on the air issue.
Heard that, and so I just cannot answer it. It would certainly be a big problem in terms of air pollution. Running out of air, I don't know. And I agree with John completely that we ought to look at the tax break situation for some of the big corporations that are responsible for promoting all this super overconsumption. Thank you very much.
Doctor, it's been a wonderful hour. It's gone much too fast. My apologies to all the callers. We may have missed a couple of there.
I thank you all for your interest.
Dr. Bartlett, thank you very much for appearing this evening. I'm Roger Wendell, and thanks to everybody for participating in the Thursday evening call-in show.